Our next speaker is Lynn Scarlett. Lynn is Executive Director of the Reason Public Policy Institute, which is a division of the Reason Foundation in California. Author of numerous papers on environmental quality, solid waste and recycling, air pollution, including a chapter in a new edition of John Bodden's book with Doug Noonan, Managing the Commons. She's also active in various environmental policy commissions. She was appointed by Governor Wilson to chair the committee overseeing changes to the automobile inspection program in California. She's chair of the How Clean is Clean working group of the National Environmental Policy Institute. She's written widely in national papers also for general audiences. Lynn's going to talk about differing visions of the environment, about the role of property rights in common law, how statute law has suspended progress in so many cases and sometimes caused harm, and about hope for the future where better institutions are developing. Let's go.
Thanks, Rick. Well, I really appreciate all of you who have stayed here through right to the end. I do want to tell Joe that she has some hope with her toilet. Virginia Postrell, who's a colleague of mine at Reason Foundation, you know, we in California do everything a little bit sooner than the rest, so we had a low flow requirement some years ago, starting about 1990. So poor Virginia remodeled her bathroom, had to put in a low flow toilet, and not having a Uzbekistan plumber, she had to buy one, but she found a low flow toilet that, boy, does this thing work. I mean, it flushes like you never. So, there's hope. I want to start by talking about conflicting visions, and recall that Japanese film, Rashomon. Many of you probably know, and in that film, there's a crime that takes place, and the film unfolds showing the four different viewpoints of the people that experience one way or another that crime. You have one single crime, so there's one observable reality, but as the film unfolds and you first see what happened through the eyes of one onlooker, and then you see what happened through the eyes of the victim, and so on, you feel as though you're watching four completely different events. And what I would like to suggest that, in many respects, environmental debates offer us kind of a Rashomon-like specter of competing perceptions. We have different interpretations of how the world works. We have one observable reality out there, but people bring to that different reflections, and different perceptions, therefore, the path of progress. What I want to do is examine two visions, one which I would suggest has undergirded the last 30 years of environmental policy in the United States, what I call the old vision, and then examine a little bit the new vision, one that is very much along the lines that you heard here today and yesterday. Now, the three components to the old vision, and this is, of course, highly stylized and simplified, but three components. First, and probably most important, the old vision thrust forth the view that environmental values are sacrosanct, that they eclipse other values, that somehow those with environmental values ought not to be traded or balanced among other values. Now, the consequence of this for public policy has been very clear. We've got, for example, zero emissions policies, that is, goals that say you have to go after the last molecule in some instances. Clean up the water cleaner than it is in its natural state, for example. Or the Endangered Species Act, about which you've heard some, in which the language in the law actually says, thou shalt not, it doesn't use those words, but thou shalt not take into consideration cause one must expect that protect all species. So environmental values are sacrosanct. Second component of the old vision was that environmental problems were the result of the marketplace in the pursuit of profit. Now, this wasn't altogether a perspective that was hard to understand. After all, if you take a snapshot of the world out there, you see factories and you see pollution, it looks like the factories cause them, and so therefore the pursuit of profit and production activities must be the cause of environmental problems. But the result of this in policy, for public policy, was a tremendous emphasis on punishment and an emphasis on what I would call a compliance straitjacket, prescribing every detail of actions that companies must undertake in order to mitigate environmental problems. In a sense, there was a notion that, gee, if you have a hammer, everything is a nail. The third component output of the old vision is that environmental problems were deemed best understood by experts, particularly experts in Washington, kind of bureaucrats in our best thesis. This started, by the way, way back when in the Progressive Era, but it began to resurface in 1960-1970. The result of that perspective was a thrusting of everything up to Washington and kind of a one-size-fits-all approach, command-style approaches to regulation, about which you've heard much, I think, in the last couple days. Now, maybe like unlike some of the other folks here, I want to suggest that these policies and this vision did lead to some results, some improvements. They were not without any effect. But I would suggest, as Horatio told Hamlet, and we all know the passage, all is not well. Specifically, we've had high conflict. We've heard Joe tell about some of those high costs, a disconnect with the dynamic and complex world that's around us, and for the purposes of today's discussion, emphasize the erosion of freedom. Now, I want to suggest that there's an alternative vision, and this is going to repeat some of what you have heard, but perhaps I've done slightly in the past, and use three components of this vision. First, with respect to values, this alternative vision, free market environmentalism, if you will, understands that environmental values are among the many values that make up quality of life, the many values that individuals hold with varying degrees of emphasis. Second, as you've heard again and again, marketplace institutions are a critical component of both environmental progress and personal freedom. Rather than being the cause of pollution, they indeed are part of the path to progress. And third, and this is an empirical component, a lot of the relevant information for understanding environmental problems does not reside in Washington. I'm sure that would surprise all of you. But in fact, it's information that is dispersed. It is what Hayek called the knowledge of time, place, and experience, or time, place, and circumstance. It's knowledge that resides at a specific factory site. It's knowledge, for example, that resides at a specific landfill in the Everglades, which is very different from a landfill in Scottsdale, Arizona. Now, why these attributes of this alternative vision of environmental progress? Well, partly it's a matter of philosophy, as you've heard today and yesterday. That is, the notion that individual freedom in and of itself is important to human flourishing. But it's also a result of observation of how the world works. And I want to highlight two features. First is the feature of complexity. The world is full of trade-offs. Full of risk trade-offs. Full of value trade-offs, of course, as any economist will tell us. But let me give you an example. Many of you a couple of years ago may remember a debate about disposable food service ware. Gee, this is terrible. We have a lot of fast food stores and all of this disposable packaging. And gee, we ought to just get rid of that. That's terribly wasteful. Well, it turns out that yes, indeed, disposable packaging by definition is disposable. You throw it away, use it once, and toss it out. But it turns out the reason it was introduced by many firms was because it actually is much more sanitary than reusable ware. A typical spoon of reusable ware, think of this while you eat this morning, has about 100 times more of the bacterial content on it, even washed in this hotel's industrial washer, than a packaged plastic spoon. Trade-offs. I see you all looking interested. With dread. Not to fear, as Bruce Ames told you yesterday, even that amount of bacteria is not really going to kill much. Now, the consequence of complexity is a need for decision-making settings in which individuals can balance among competing ends using their own local knowledge and their own personal values. Now, the second feature about how the world works that I want to talk about is the importance of dynamism and creativity. What Joy and Simon call the ultimate resource, and that is human action and the human mind. There are many ways to do more with less. That is, many ways to conserve. Property rights create the context for competition. They create the context in which prices emerge. Those prices are a form of information. They give us information on the relative scarcities of different resources. And I like to say competition, like hanging, concentrates the mind. young to remember that, but let's hypothesize. In the 1950s, you would open the newspaper and see we're in the information age, we're at the dawn of the information age. Telecommunications is beginning to span the globe, and guess what? Telecommunications needs copper wire to transmit those messages. But oh my goodness, as this telecommunications network grows, we're running out of copper. This information age is going to come to a halt. Well, of course, the price of copper climbed. That put a bee in someone's bonnet. It wasn't quite this simple, but more or less. Put a bee in someone's bonnet. They said, is there a substitute? And they went out and looked on the beach and saw sand. And guess what? They created five rockets. Now, it turns out this is an environmental triumph because 25 kilos of silica produces a cable over which some 40 times the messages can flow that could be made from a cable of copper that required one ton. Think of compact discs. How many of you remember you used to call up information on the telephone? And the operator would thumb through a bunch of phone books and find the number. Another environmental triumph. Today, that one compact disc can carry on it 90 million telephone numbers. And for all those operators, guess what? That replaces 5 tons of phone books. And now for my favorite, I gotta do this. Even in small things, we've had this conservation effort. Many of you remember the 1960s when it was a sign of virility to crush this can. I am much too young to remember. But it was a sign of virility to crush this can, below the small, I put the one hand. Now, why is that? It took 164 pounds of metal to make 1,000 cans. And today it takes 33 pounds of metal. Now, I would suggest to you that that creativity is the unglamorous right stuff of environmental progress. Now, this little tale recasts the environmental challenge, it seems to me, that we face. The key question and the key challenge we face is what institutions, what decision-making structures are pivotal to the process of conservation, creativity, private stewardship, and the expression of personal values, values that each of us holds independently and individually. Most environmental problems, as you've heard many speakers suggest, actually are some kind of commons problem, or in some instances, what I would call an information constraint problem. Commons, as R.J. told us, is a circumstance in which unfettered access to commonly held resources leads to despoilation. But we have information problems too, information constraints. For example, as some of the people talking about risk told you, sometimes there's a time lag between an action and the consequence of that action. For example, between the emission of a particular chemical and any health results that might occur. So there's a kind of time lag and information constraint. And there's sometimes an asymmetry of information between or among transacting parties. Now let me take first the commons issue and the role of property rights. As you've heard, and so I can just summarize very briefly, property rights define where your sphere of autonomy ends and mine begins. They link the individual actions that we take to the consequences for those actions, but they also create fields of dreams. They make possible Rosalie Edge attempt and indeed success in saving Hawk Mountain. She was able to simply purchase that mountain and create her field of dream. Now, beyond private spheres of autonomy, as Rick suggested, action is circumscribed by a do-no-harm principle. Old-fashioned common law was essentially a discovery process. It was a discovery process about defining those boundaries. In those blurry realms where your rights and mine intersected, it was about determining what is a harm and what is a harm? What is trespass and what isn't? Statutory law, as I believe you heard yesterday from Bruce Yandel, largely eclipsed that discovery process. It interrupted that discovery process. The challenge is how do we reestablish that discovery process in property rights where there are blurry or non-existent rights? And I want to mention just a few quickly. This challenge spans the easy, the very easy. It's quite easy to set up a Hawk Mountain, simply purchase the property and thereby preserve the fishing foul, and so forth. But there are some challenges that are much more difficult. It's difficult sometimes, for example, where you, by necessity, for some reason, need common management of a property. So you have experiments in, for example, Switzerland, with alpine forest management, in which farmers that have land abutting the alpine forests wanted to commonly be able to use those forests, but of course they didn't want to all go chop them down with pure open access. So in some tales written by Eleanor Ostrom, Indiana University, she talks about how they worked out privately held property, but essentially commonly managed. Now there's a linkage approach. Sometimes you can use the marketplace to save one value and kind of lead along other values while you're at it. The Living Desert in California, it's essentially a zoo, and people pay money to go there, and they pay lots of money. It's purely privately owned and operated. But they use those revenues of the zoo to actually set aside some wilderness preserves separately where people cannot go. So at one time they provide a zoo, something people will pay for, and link it to some other values that perhaps people wouldn't pay for. But some problems are even more difficult, and these are the ones that I typically deal with. Problems of fluid resources, such as air bases, air at the air basin, or water, or to some extent oceans and ocean fish. There are experiments to try and define rights to ocean fish. New Zealand experimenting with tradable quotas, imperfect, but the attempt is to try and define some kind of rights. The UK, rather than using our kind of bludgeon approach with respect to eagle protection, came up with an idea of finding out just exactly how much damage those eagles did to sheep, lambs. And then they went to the Lloyd's of London and said, gee, what would an insurance policy cost for us to buy insurance to protect the farmers against those losses? That was a fairly modest amount. And then they went to the farmers and said, don't kill the eagle if it happens to destroy one of your lambs. Come to us and we'll compensate you for the insurance program. Manufacturers in the United States, right now, and even under this dreadful and draconian top-down regulation that we have, are experimenting with bargaining approaches, simply getting together with neighbors around their factories and saying, you know, what do you care about? What harms do you care about? And how can we protect you against those harms or compensate you for them? Returning to the old kind of negotiated bargaining approach that Coase and others talk about. I'm going to conclude because my time is nearly up and just remind folks that the market is no particular set of institutions. Often we think of the marketplace as property rights with a picket fence. The market is no particular set of institutions. Indeed, as we have unmet needs, the marketplace is an invitation for entrepreneurs to come forth with new institutional arrangements and new ways to overcome those information constraints that I talked about. Corn farmers back in the 19th century had a real information constraint problem in marketing their corn. One of the problems was you might have a bushel here and it would sell for $5, and the guy just 30 miles away, he was finding a buyer for $10. The other problem was you didn't want to buy your corn sight unseen because you didn't know how many stones and pebbles would be mixed in with the corn. So what they did, they created the Chicago Board of Trade. And the purpose was, number one, to provide better flow of information about available buyers and sellers, but also to set standards so that you can know what you were buying and actually have futures markets. And that, of course, reduced the volatility of the markets. The same kind of invention is occurring in the environmental arena. So the environmental challenge we face is how to evolve these institutions. And by the way, this is a challenge within firms. Firms are constantly redesigning their own organizational structure to better enhance information feedback and better identify prospects for reducing waste within the firm or within their products. But it's also a challenge within the world of governance. How do we nurture these bargaining and negotiated kinds of solutions where rights intersect? How do we better define rights where they're blurry? In conclusion, I want to note, I think we all want a less arduous and more delightful world.